Start off here in verse 24, and we'll work our way here. Here we go, verse 24, chapter 21 of the book of John. This is the disciple who is bearing witness about these things and who has written these things, and we know that his testimony is true. Verse 25, now there are also many other things that Jesus did. Were one of them to be written, I suppose that the world itself could not contain the books that would be written. So there's a lot there. Let me ask you this question to start us off. Raise your hand if you have ever seen the movie Finding Nemo. Raise your hand if you've seen this movie. It's a really good Pixar movie, Disney movie. And pretty much the major focus of Finding Nemo is about a dad by the name of Marlin. And Marlin is trying to do what? Find Nemo, that's right. So Nemo gets taken away from some humans. And so the whole movie is all about Marlin being completely devoted to finding his son. And if you've watched that movie, Marlin is willing to do whatever it takes to stay focused on the mission that he has to find Nemo. He's willing to limit distractions. He's willing to swim through jellyfish to find something that he cares about the most. So likewise, John ends this book sort of in a similar fashion. Here's what I mean by that. John's going to end this book by saying that the whole book is focused on one objective thing, that there's a centerpiece of the book of John, and it's not finding Nemo, but it's the person of Jesus Christ. And so John's going to kind of land the plane in the Gospel of John, communicating to us how Jesus is the main thing. Y'all, we've been in the Gospel of John for 37 weeks, for about 8.5 months. We divided it up a little bit, but we've been in this book for a very, very long time. And so we're going to have a chance to close the book out by looking at this. And just so you know, I've modified my notes. I got your back. This will probably be one of the shortest sermons you've heard me preach, okay? But here we go. First thing I want you to notice in verse 24, that John identifies himself as the author of the book. If you go back up to verse 20, you can read that later on this afternoon if you'd like, but there's this dialogue between Peter and Jesus and ultimately John. And what John does there in verse 24 is John says, I'm the one that has authored this book. This is sort of like his signature at the end of the letter. And I don't want to spend too much time on this, but I just think it's kind of cool that the way that God has given us these four books in the Bible called the Gospels. If you've never heard that term before, you have Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And all four of those books are really focused in on the life and the ministry and the death and the resurrection of Jesus. They tell the same story about the person of Christ from four different perspectives. John probably wrote after the first three, and John is writing from his particular angle. And the reason I say this is significant is because a different perspective sometimes is important, especially if you're trying to get to what's true. Because what's cool about the gospel is you have different perspectives, but they're all communicating the same idea. So let me give you an example of why perspective is important. So for me to go through the interview process with the North American Mission Board so I could be like an official church planter of that organization, I had to go through like a pretty extensive, like three stages interview process. Well, one of those interviewing process was one of the most invasive things I've ever done. So what they did is they gave me like 99 questions. Let's just say it's 100 questions. And I had to fill them out. So, and it was like, gauge yourself, grade yourself. I love those because I'm insecure, right? I give myself too much credit sometimes and I don't give myself credit enough. It's like, how good are you with your anger? On 5 being you're great at it, 1, 0 being you're just trash at it. And you got to do that for yourself. And then here's what they do, which is really brilliant from an interviewing standpoint. They take those same questions about you and they give them to 6 people that you're close to. And it's 6 people, some of those have to be your mentors, some of them have to be your boss, some of them have to be family members, and they go through all of those questions and they evaluate you. And here's what they're trying to see. They're not trying to see that you're perfect. They're trying to see that if you have self-awareness and that what you perceive yourself as is in harmony with the way the other people perceive you. So what they're trying to figure out is if in my evaluation of me, I say, I'm great with money. Money's no problem at all. But then they ask Audrey and 6 mentors of mine, and all of them are like, Daniel is not good at all with money. Don't trust him with that. Find somebody else in the church to run the money, right? So this would be, they're looking for self-awareness. They want to know that you're able to do that because perspective is important. And this is why the Gospels are so cool, because John is writing from a particular perspective. He's writing to communicate a central idea. So I want you to go back to verse 31 of the previous chapter in chapter 20. Because what you find in chapter 20, verse 31, is really the summary of the whole book. We read it the first week, and I want to go back to it. Here's what he says. But these are written so that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. So what John says there is, John says, I'm not just writing a book about Jesus randomly. I'm writing for a particular mission, for a particular purpose. And whatever's in the book can't be a distraction from what the main thing is about, which is Christ. And what John says is, I'm writing this in order that anybody that reads it would come to the conclusion that Jesus is the Christ. He is the promised Messiah. That Jesus is fully God and he is fully man. That he's not kind of like a God. He doesn't become God when tradition and his legend grows in the early church. He is God. And that you might believe on his name and have eternal life. So the whole focus of the book is to say that it's all about Jesus and knowing him and living a life in relationship with him and allowing Christ to change your life when you see how amazing and glorious he really is. So I want to make a really quick point of application, then we'll move forward. Look, I don't want to assume everybody in this room knows Jesus. Look, we got all the kids in here, and kids sometimes process things differently than we do. But if you're here, I would just say, have you been convinced that Jesus is the Christ? Have you been convinced that Jesus is God, that Jesus is who he said that he was? Have you believed the good news of Jesus, the gospel, that Christ has died in our place? And this is the way I share the gospel with my kids. It seems to work with them. I don't know if it'll work with yours, but here's how I communicate the gospel to them. So the gospel is essentially this idea that, so imagine with me that you have a horrible, deadly disease, and it's really bad. And I always look at my kids and I say, if you had that disease, what would happen to you? And the kids will always say, well, I would die if I had that, you know? It's not good. But I come to them and I say, well, what if I told you I had this special piece of technology? But the caveat of the technology is I can heal you, but the problem is I got to take that disease out of you and I got to put it inside of me, which is good news. And then I ask them, I said, if I can take that disease out of you, what happens to you? They'll say, I live. And I say, well, what happens to me when I put it in me? And they say, well, the problem is you would die. And see, this is the gospel. The gospel is that Jesus has taken our sin on himself so that he could die in our place. And he's risen from the dead, offering eternal life to anybody who would believe in him. And so if you're not a Christian, I'd invite you to trust Christ today. And if you're an adult and you want to talk more, I'll be around at the end of the service, and I'd love to show you what that looks like. If you're a kid, the best person for you to talk to is your parents. The best person to lead you to Christ is your mom or your dad or a grandparent. And so, and parents in this room, if you don't know how to have that conversation, we would love to coach you and to walk with you over how to do that. But if you want to trust Christ, I would say believe the gospel this morning. The second thing in the text that I think is really cool is John reiterates this idea that Jesus is the main picture in verse 25. The way he says that is kind of a strange way. He says, now there are also many other things that Jesus did. Were all of them to be written down, I suppose the world itself could not contain those books that would be written. Now, there's a little bit of conversation around what exactly does John mean by that. I'm prone to think that John is using a literary device called hyperbole. Hyperbole is simple. It's a way that sometimes an author might exaggerate something to communicate a deeper point. And we use exaggeration all the time in language, don't we? So, for example, have you guys ever said, I'm so hungry, I'm going to starve? You ever said that before? The reality is most of us live in America, and we have no clue what it's actually like to starve to death. Many of us, we have more food than we'll ever need, and so we're never going to really starve, most of us here. But we say that to exaggerate, to prove a point, which is, I'm really hungry. Some people might say, I'm hangry, you know what I'm saying? Like, I'm getting angry because I need to get some food. So I don't necessarily think John is literally saying that if we could have, like, dozens of scribes with papyrus and scrolls and paper and pens, and they were writing down every single thing that Jesus is doing, that we wouldn't have had enough paper in the whole universe to. I don't think he's saying that. I think he's using hyperbole to communicate a deep truth. And here's what he's trying to communicate: that Jesus is amazing and glorious, and the whole world cannot contain his glory. What John is trying to say is, he's saying there's no bookstore or digital Kindle that's got enough gigs that could contain Jesus. That God is sovereign, God is providential, he's holy, he's righteous, and he's powerful. He's the firstborn over all creation and the second person in the Trinity, that he's too big and he's too awesome to be limited and dumbed down to papers and libraries. He's the main thing. And I want you to look at verse 24 and 25. Notice sort of the distinction between those two verses. It's as is in verse 24, John is saying, I'm the guy that wrote the book. But he jumps right back to what the focus of the book is about in verse 25. It's as if John is trying to say that, yeah, I'm the one that has penned these words, but these words have really just been about Christ. That I'm the author, but don't forget the main character of the story, which is Jesus and all that he's done. In the words of Alistair Begg, the main thing is the main thing, which is Christ, not John. And so an analogy that I think is super helpful that I heard from another pastor by the name of J.D. Greer is he describes that every Christian needs to have something called the Copernican revolution of their heart. I don't know if you guys know who Nicholas Copernicus is, but he made an argument back in the day. The argument was that the earth actually orbited the sun, and the earth was spinning on its axis around the sun. And for you and I in 2024, we're kind of like, that's a no-brainer. Everybody knows that, right? But you got to understand, when he first said that, that was a revolutionary idea. Because prior to Copernicus making this argument, the belief was that the earth was the center of the universe. I don't know if you guys can see that. That's a ChatGPT image, just so you know. It's pretty excited that ChatGPT made that. But the thing is, that's the way people viewed the solar system before Copernicus in the early 1500s. Their perspective was that we were at the center of everything, and the sun actually revolved around the earth. And then Copernicus shows up and says, yeah, but I'm looking at the data, I'm looking at the science, and the science seems to communicate something different. That the earth is not at the center of the universe, but the sun is. And so the second image is going to look like this, which is obviously what we have today. That the sun is the center, and we actually revolve around the sun. And what Greer says is that he says that every Christian needs to have that kind of revolution in their heart. That they need to have this shift, instead of believing that we are the center of the universe, and us believing that life is all about us, we need to recognize that Christ is the center of all things. That we don't take Jesus and let him just orbit our life whenever it's convenient for us. We understand that Jesus is the center of all things for us. That he's the hero of the story. We don't just sprinkle him in a little bit. We recognize that it's all about him. So here's what I want to do. I want to apply this to two demographics in our church. And then I want us collectively as the body to pray with one another. Okay? So here's demographic number one. If you're in the room and maybe you're single, not married. Now, singleness is kind of an interesting dynamic because it's such a wide spectrum of context. There are some single people who have kids, but I want to speak to maybe you in this room that don't have kids who are single. And so I would just encourage you during this season of your life to not squander it by giving all of your attention and your energy and your resources to good things instead of devoting your life to the best thing, which is Christ. See, it would be somewhat of a mistake to live your life focused on living for just more money or better vacations or more travel. Or advancing in your career, or living for more leisure time on the weekend, or having some sort of hobby that you might have. Now hear me out, there's nothing wrong with any of those things I just mentioned. And if you're here and you're single and you're passionate about those things, I'm not saying that's wrong, but I am just throwing your way that the bottom line is that those cannot be the center of our lives. If the center of your life as a single person is money or your career, then something's out of order. Because the center of our lives has to be Christ and his glory. And the reason it's so important when you're single, there's exceptions to this, but most of the time who you are as a single person is who you'll be as a married person. And if right now in this season of life you're not focused on what matters the most, that's probably not going to magically happen apart from a supernatural work of God in your heart after you get married. And so I would just encourage you during this time to leverage it for the glory of God, to be focused on Christ in all things. So if you're trying to make money and you're trying to advance your career, how does that glorify God? How does Christ stay the center of all things when you go that route? The second demographic in the church I want to share is to the parents in the room. And I want to kind of share a story that I experienced this last week. And 100% I'm going to cry because it was really powerful. And I'm going to cry. So I had a chance this last week to sit with a man in his early 80s. His name's John. He's actually sitting over here today. And John recently found out that he's got a pretty severe form of cancer. And so John is in his 80s. He's a Christian. He's been a Christian longer than I've been alive. He's been a minister of the gospel longer than I've been alive, okay? He's a seasoned veteran. And John said, look, I know where I'm going to go when I'm going to die, and I'm not worried about this. I'm going to go be with Jesus. And so I'm sitting with him, and I'm just visiting, trying to hear their story. And so I said, hey, do you mind sharing your testimony with me? Like how did you become a Christian? You know, and the first thing he said to me was, he said it was because of my mom. And he began to tell me story after story after story where he said, my mom would bring me to church. He had a dad that really wasn't all that committed to Christ early on, and he just said, my mom loved me well. And she not only brought me to church, but she not only taught me who Jesus was, but she modeled who Jesus was. And right towards at the end of him sharing that, y'all, here he is in his late 80s. His mother's been dead for a long time. He said, he just began to weep, and he said, my mother was a wonderful mom. And I had this epiphany that I've known, but it was like the Lord had to remind me. And here's the epiphany. That the greatest person to impact your kids is us as moms and dads. That here was this man in his early 80s. His mother's been gone for a long time. And he's talking about one of the greatest influences in his life. And he was saying, it was my mom. And I thought, like, man, that is what I want my kids to say about me when I'm gone. And so I just want to say a quick word to all the moms and dads in the room. You need to know the greatest impact on your kids is you. I understand that we may feel like sometimes the greatest influence on our children is their peers or the school they go to or social media or something like that. And I'm not saying those things don't influence them. I'm not. But I am saying none of those things will impact their life for eternity the way that you will. And I don't know about you, but when I see that in the scriptures, and I realize that as a dad, I feel a weightiness with that. Like this deep sense of responsibility. And here's what I think. I just think I don't want to mess that up. I just think I only get this one shot with my kids. You know what I'm saying? And I don't want to botch it. And here's the issue for us as parents. There's a lot of things distracting us from the mission of teaching them who Jesus is. What's even more dangerous is there's a lot of things in our lives that are not evil, good things that distract us from the main thing, which is teaching them who Christ is and what he's done for them. And so I just want to encourage you, moms and dads in this room, to be beeline focused on the mission of raising your kids up in the fear and admonition of the Lord. For you to say, I as a mom or a dad want to accomplish the thing that God's put me here for since I have kids, if you're a Christian, which is to raise my kids to understand that Jesus is the center of all things. And raise them in that. And if you don't know how to do that, and you've never been taught that, because what we've experienced at the branch, a lot of people come here that are kind of unchurched, or they're really new in this Christian faith. And so a lot of people, that wasn't modeled to them, and so they don't know how. If that's you as a parent, we would love to walk with you and to try to help you understand what that looks like.